This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Astral Weeks, A Secret History of 1968 by Ryan H. Walsh. Read for you by Stephen Hoy. Prologue. In the beginning. You know this story. At the 1965 Newport Folk Festival, 23-year-old singer, songwriter, and future Nobel laureate Bob Dylan defiantly led his band through a decibel-pushing, distortion-heavy electric set, including Maggie's Farm and Like a Rolling Stone, shocking folk purists. If I had an axe, I'd chop the microphone cable right now, Pete Seeger grumbled. Fans booed, organizers were aghast, and Dylan had turned himself into someone else. It's one of the true culture-shifting moments in rock and roll history. But what else happened that night? Though other acts followed Dylan, the evening was enveloped by a confused, mournful feeling. The festival was now a funeral. One musician was so upset by Dylan's set that he performed an unscheduled coda. On the empty, unlit Newport stage, a skinny 27-year-old harmonica player named Mel Lyman closed out the proceedings. I wanted to save the world with music. I still do, but I was more naive at that time, Lyman told a reporter in 1971. I kept having this fucking recurring image in my sleep of playing Rock of Ages. Every night I'd toss around in bed. I'd say, don't make me do it. Don't make me do it. Finally, I said, okay, if it's got to be done, I'll do it. Lyman was at Newport as part of Jim Queskin's jug band, but their performance had ended long before Dylan's heretical set. As crowds streamed toward the exit, Lyman pushed out a eulogy through his instrument. I played Rock of Ages. The people heard it as they were leaving, but it was more for the musicians than the people, Lyman explained. The musicians were spellbound. They were hearing what they should have been doing. Some of the musicians were crying. I was told that later. I must have lost 10 pounds during that song. The sweat was just pouring down. The spirit was so strong I could barely get it out. You know, the harmonica. That's a pretty tiny hole for all that spirit to go through. That little tiny reed. According to some reports, his rendition of Rock of Ages went on for half an hour. Within 18 months of this performance, Mel Lyman would commandeer an entire neighborhood of run-down houses in the Fort Hill area of Roxbury, an impoverished part of Boston, issue cuss-laden pronouncements through an influential underground newspaper, and declare he was God to anyone who would listen. By early 1968, more than 100 people lived with Mel in his Fort Hill community. Their stated goal was ever-changing and hard to pin down, but on several occasions Lyman family members spoke to the press about creating the most beautiful music the world has ever known, and it seemed that they were hell-bent on making this music in a style that was in direct opposition to Dylan's Newport act. The Lymans rejected electric instruments, embracing traditional American folk stylings as a way to transform their lives. The most beautiful music the world has ever known. Some of the music that emerged from Fort Hill was certainly lovely, but this story starts with a man who undeniably made good on a similar ambition, at the same time and in the same place. He came to the idea himself, by way of a dream. In early 1968, 7 miles from Mel Lyman's Fort Hill community and across the Charles River, a 21-year-old Van Morrison had just found himself the holder of a lease for an apartment on Green Street in Cambridge, Massachusetts. He was about to make a masterpiece. Born in 1945 in Belfast, Ireland, George Ivan Morrison started writing poetry as a child, before I knew what poetry was. His father's vast record collection, acquired during a trip to the States, introduced Van to the mysterious world of American blues through artists like Leadbelly and Jelly Roll Morton. Beginning his music career as a teenager, he played saxophone and guitar for several acts before finding acclaim as the frontman of R&B act Them, who first toured America in 1966. A stint at the Whiskey A Go-Go in Los Angeles led to the band jamming with Jim Morrison, sharing a bill with Captain Beefheart, and despite a 50% alcohol discount, running up a $2,600 tab. Another anecdote involved Van borrowing a guitar, smashing it on stage, then casually telling the sobbing ex-axe owner, "That's art, man." On June 23rd, Them appeared in San Francisco, where Morrison met Janet Rigsby, a 19-year-old Bay Area model and aspiring actress. "I looked at him, he looked at me, and it was alchemical whammo," she said. "I had never been to a rock concert before. We really connected in a very spiritual way. So we tried to spend as much time together as we could while he was touring up and down California." One night he would perform well, and the next night he would just glower at the audience, Them guitarist Jim Armstrong recalled. Between shows, Morrison was putting together the lyrics for Ballerina, an ode to Janet, and one of the first pieces of Astral Weeks to be written. When Them's work visas were not extended, the band returned to Ireland, where Van abruptly left the group. He spent part of his tour earnings on a reel-to-reel tape recorder, planted it at his parents' house, and laid down countless hours of song ideas. He pined for Janet, trying to figure out what would come next. Described by one biographer as reeking of Paul Mall's cheap cologne and hit records, producer Burt Burns was no one's idea of a savior, but in 1967, Van Morrison wasn't in a position to be choosy. Burns had been the first American producer to work with Them. Morrison had been immediately enamored when he learned that Burns had written "I Don't Want to Go On Without You" for the Drifters. Burns introduced Them to Overdubs, and a song of his called "Here Comes the Night." Their version went to number 2 in the United Kingdom and number 24 in the United States. Burns could have attached himself to one of the several post-Morrison versions of Them, but he knew to bet on the talented but currently aimless singer. Burns hoped that Morrison could become a rock and roll version of the Irish poet Brendan Behan, a unique vision, to say the least. He offered $2,500 to sign a contract that a desperate Morrison barely reviewed. Arriving in New York in 1967, Morrison was puzzled by what he found in the studio. "I showed up for the session, and 40 people are there," he later explained to a Warner Brothers executive. "Four guitar players, 4 keyboard players, 5 singers, 4 entire rhythm sections. It was bizarre." In banter heard before one outtake, Morrison wishes it could be freer, remarking, "At the minute, we have a choke thing going. Know what I mean?" No one did. One photo reveals an exhausted Morrison, head in his hands. Burt Burns was calling most of the shots at these sessions. He changed the lyrics and title of "Brown-Skinned Girl" at the last minute to the version we all know so well today. When Morrison was finally allowed to lay down TB sheets in the style and arrangement he was comfortable with, he ended up sobbing in the vocal booth. "He was just torn apart," engineer Brooks Arthur recalled. "He was sitting on the floor in a heap like a wrung-out dishcloth, completely spent emotionally." After 2 days, Burns sent him back to Belfast. The producer would bring Morrison back to the States only if one of the songs became a hit. The singer told Janet that if she heard him on the radio, it meant he was on his way to find her. Luckily, Brown Eyed Girl spent 16 weeks on the Billboard charts, peaking at number 10. Burns flew Morrison back to New York. Looking for more hits, Burns was agitated when the singer played him stream-of-consciousness demos he had recorded in Belfast. Eileen Burns, the producer's young wife, said that Morrison was out of control, even after Janet joined him in New York. Morrison would sabotage press showcases and studio sessions without warning. At a show at the Bottom Line, his onstage behavior caused the backup singers to flee mid-set. During one recording session, he flung his guitar at a wall and screamed at the musicians, who couldn't sort out the particular issue through his Irish accent. On December 30, 1967, not long after an intense argument between Burns and Morrison, the producer died of a heart attack at the age of 38. Eileen was not shy about blaming Morrison. Van and Janet did not attend the funeral, which they later admitted was a terrible mistake. In early 1968, the couple relocated to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Morrison biographies tend to gloss over this pivotal moment. I wanted to find out why he came here, and why he left. Astral Weeks is my favorite record of all time. Like its eloquent champion, Lester Bangs, I also believe the record to be some kind of mystical document, despite the decidedly gritty circumstances around its creation. When I discovered it at 22, I was experiencing my first true heartbreak. I felt like a shell of myself, carved out by loneliness. In my final year at Boston University, I'd fallen madly in love with someone, but she was torn between me and her longtime hometown boyfriend. Enter my upstairs neighbor, a palm reader whom I only knew as grandmother. She called me grandson. Studying our hands in the dim light of her apartment, she concluded that a cosmic accident had allowed us to meet. But that didn't mean we would stay together. Grandmother turned out to be right. The woman I loved moved to San Francisco, and something held me back. I stayed in Boston, where I was born and raised. I had never heard of Astral Weeks. I was indifferent to Van Morrison, but something about seeing the cover there in a record store rack in Newton commanded me to slap down $11 and take it home. From the very first notes, the music seemed to serve as some kind of protection for the part of me that held on to hope and the idea of real love. A force field grew around me with each listen, as songs like Sweet Thing and Madame George helped beat back any encroaching cynicism. The album had presented itself in a moment when I needed to hear it, promising that I was not alone in my despair. Years later, I met a woman who put on Astral Weeks at the end of our first date. As the title track began and she held up the vinyl album cover, smiling, I can only assume my jaw hit the floor. I recalled all that talk about cosmic accidents and wondered if I was in the middle of another one. Listener, I married her. At some point, I learned that part of the album's origin story lay in my own backyard, which struck me as beyond coincidence. Over the years, I came to believe that if I could piece together the story of Van Morrison's time on my native soil, in those months before the album came out, I would understand something vital about the music that had buoyed me in those dark days. While researching the album's half-buried local connections, my curiosity about Boston in the late 60s grew into obsession. The music scene from which Van Morrison stocked his band and the deeply strange tale of Mel Lyman's Fort Hill community suggested an incredibly rich artistic past forgotten by all but a few present-day residents. As a musician myself, with a band operating out of Boston for more than 10 years, I'd spent a good chunk of my life immersed in the city's music scene. So why hadn't these stories been passed around like legends at the Silhouette Lounge or the Middle East? Why was I blown away to learn that proto-punk and Natick native Jonathan Richman thought of Boston when he listened to Astral Weeks? Legendary groups like Aerosmith sprouted up in the city in the 70s, but I was more interested in what came before. Dylan's electrified set at Newport, it seemed, had served as the inciting action for a sea change in Boston's counterculture, literally driving people mad and making others treat the divisions between folk and rock like lines on a battlefield. Van Morrison and Mel Lyman embodied these struggles, and nearly everyone I spoke to had a story about one of them. In a piece about the Pixies, Pitchfork sniffed, "Boston, a famous place but fiercely provincial, with all the reticence of small-town New England and almost no cosmopolitan sheen. We can always depend on Boston for more sports and software engineers." This is a story about Boston before tech innovation and athletic dominance became the city's calling cards. Back when LSD and the occult, protest, and serial murders were the subjects of most national news stories about life inside the cradle of liberty. From the comedy of errors that was MGM Records' attempt to launch the Boston Sound, to the Velvet Underground's near constant formative residency at the Boston Tea Party, to the groundbreaking weirdness being aired weekly on WGBH, looking back on Boston in 1968 is like catching a glimpse of an upside-down, hallucinogenic version of the thriving metropolis that stands today. During the 1950s, Boston lost more residents than any other major city in America. Redevelopment efforts stalled in the early 60s. Neighborhoods seen today as highly desirable were all but abandoned. When Mayor Kevin White was sworn into office on January 1, 1968, he spoke of a new Boston, with plans to fill the city of 48 square miles with people of exceptional talent. He could never have imagined the group of eccentrics who would, almost instantly, make his public pledge a reality. The story of the late 60s counterculture in America has been told before, especially in regard to the drama unfolding in San Francisco, Chicago, and New York. But what happened in Boston has gone largely unremarked. Perhaps it has to do with the city's Puritan roots, a natural inclination to sweep anything but victories under the rug. This is the secret history of Boston in 1968. About people desperately hunting for something intangible and incandescent, many of whom referred to that something as God. Some found it, embodied it, or impersonated it. Others were crushed by it. As Marilyn French wrote in The Women's Room, her best-selling novel inspired by her time at Harvard in 1968, that year itself was an open door, but a magical one. Once you went through it, you could never return. Chapter 1. Against Electricity. John Sheldon was 17 years old when a frowning, baby-faced Irishman showed up at the door of his parents' house in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Sheldon, a guitar prodigy, had recently auditioned for The Songwriter. Now here the guy was on his porch, all 5'5" of him, with a local upright bass player looming over his shoulder. The teenager didn't know what to make of him. He didn't say very much. We played for a while, and the first thing I remember him saying was, "Are you available for gigs?" And that was how John Sheldon became the guitarist for Van Morrison during the summer of 1968. Morrison was still riding the buzz of Brown Eyed Girl, but he certainly wasn't a household name. His adopted hometown didn't pay him special attention. "I remember one gig at the Boston Tea Party," Sheldon said, "but we had no drummer." With Van and the bass player, Tom Kilbanya, they drove by Berklee School of Music and saw this guy on the sidewalk. Tom said, "Hey, it's Joe. Joe, do you want to play drums?" This is the kind of level that things were happening at then. Morrison became a constant presence in the Sheldon household. He would tie up the family phone, carrying on epic arguments with Eileen Burns over royalties for Brown Eyed Girl. My parents would come down for breakfast on Sunday, Sheldon recalls, and it would be a bunch of people they didn't know. Morrison even tried to convince Sheldon's mother to let him move into one of the rooms, along with his wife Janet and her son from a previous relationship, Peter. Mrs. Sheldon firmly said no, but not because she was a square. You have to remember this is the same house that James Taylor and other musicians would just hang out at, Sheldon says. Taylor had become a family friend after dating John's older sister, Phoebe, which is how he ended up teaching Sheldon the basics on a red duosonic Fender he sold him for $100. His parents sometimes complained about the flurry of musicians, but I think that they liked it more than they didn't, Sheldon says. It was something that was good for me. I didn't have much else going. I wasn't doing well in school or anything. According to Sheldon, one day Morrison showed up at rehearsal with some news. He had a dream in which there were no more electric instruments. It was unclear to Sheldon if Morrison's overnight vision was specifically about the band or the world at large, but the singer proceeded to translate his dream into a reality. Kilbanya played a stand-up bass. Sheldon moved to acoustic guitar. There would be no more drums. That's when we started playing songs like Madame George, Sheldon says. But he was perplexed. Van had taken me to see Jeff Beck and introduced me, and I thought Jeff Beck was awesome. I wanted to do that kind of music. I didn't want to go back to playing acoustic guitars. Sheldon didn't have a philosophical stance on electric versus folk. He just knew what excited him. Even strangers would judge his allegiance harshly. I got off the subway in Harvard Square with my first electric guitar sticking out of a paper bag, and a guy said, "Oh, another one for the other team." After a long summer of hitting the New England circuit hard with dozens of live shows, Van Morrison was summoned to meet a record producer named Louis Merenstein at Ace Recording Studios, across from Boston Common at 1 Boylston Place, a wide commercial alley off the busy main road. It was hard to miss, with its neon sign and a blinking arrow pointing to the front door. Owned by brothers Milton and Herbert Yakus, Ace was a four-track facility whose specialty was recording jingles and song poems. Someone would bring a poem in, and for a fee, Milton would compose a song around the words, while Herbert arranged a recording with session players. The author would then own a song he or she had written, amusing friends and family upon playback. Accounts vary about whether Morrison and his band came to Ace just to audition for Merenstein, or if they had already been holed up for a few days to record some demos. Merenstein was familiar with the studio, having worked freelance there in the past. Now Morrison sat before him and began strumming a new song. "If I ventured in the slipstream between the viaducts of your dreams." 30 seconds in, "My whole being was vibrating," Merenstein said in 2008. "I knew he was being reborn. I knew I wanted to work with him at that moment." John Sheldon remembered the producer telling Morrison, "I think you're a genius, and I want you to make a record for Warner Brothers." It was clear to the young guitarist that Merenstein wasn't talking to any of the other band members. The song Van Morrison played that day, the one that so unhinged the producer, was called Astral Weeks, and it would become the title track on the album that would redefine Morrison's career. That audition at Ace was the last time Sheldon was involved with the singer. His hunch had been correct. When Morrison left to record Astral Weeks in New York soon after, he didn't take Sheldon with him. These days, the guitarist holds on to a shining memory from that summer of Morrison sitting in his parents' yard in Cambridge playing those songs from Astral Weeks. He's out in the sun, and they're very melancholy. They're mournful songs. Sheldon wanted to rock, though. His ouster would lead him back to his beloved electric guitar and a new band called Beat Game. Maybe 10 years later, a friend of mine got me stoned and put on Astral Weeks, and I went, "Hey, man, this is good." Lauded as one of the greatest albums in the rock and roll canon, Astral Weeks feels less like rock, more like a benediction, a song cycle of rebirth. Martin Scorsese claims the first 15 minutes of Taxi Driver are based on it. Philip Seymour Hoffman quoted it in his Oscar acceptance speech. Elvis Costello called it the most adventurous record made in the rock medium. Part of the late Jeff Buckley's own myth is tied with his choice to cover The Way Young Lovers Do. The critic Lester Bangs claimed it contained the quality of a beacon. Joni Mitchell was so taken aback by the album that she badgered one of Van's guitarists for information about him before finally meeting him. "What is he actually like?" Morrison once told an interviewer that the songs on Astral Weeks were just channeled. They just came through. The mystical layer adds to its allure, though the details of its origin are full of incidents that are anything but. It's an album that was planned, shaped, and rehearsed in Boston and Cambridge. This fact has been a secret kept in plain view. The first clue is right on the album sleeve, a poem filled with Bay State references. "I saw you coming from the Cape, way from Hyannisport all the way. I saw you coming from Cambridgeport with my poetry and jazz." The reasons that Van Morrison lived in the Boston area in 1968 are, to say the least, unexpected. Astral Weeks, it turns out, was born out of sheer desperation, conceived at a time when Morrison was trapped in a uniformly terrible recording contract and evading music industry thugs during a year when America seemed hell-bent on ripping itself apart. Despite being the author of that lousy contract, producer Burt Burns had genuine affection for the moody singer from Belfast. Their working relationship was made up of both confrontations and victories. Burt loved and identified with the rebel in Van, but wanted to keep him closer to the center when making records, engineer Brooks Arthur recalled to biographer Clinton Halen. Van was obsessed with feel. Burt had great commercial sense. In the pursuit of hits, Burns latched on to trends quickly. This is how the late 60s wave of psychedelia became forever tied to Morrison's debut solo album, Blowin' Your Mind, without the singer's knowledge, in 1967, complete with a cover sporting trippy fonts and a photograph of a visibly sweaty Morrison, clearly meant to convey that the drugs had just kicked in. The liner notes double down on the concept. And Van blows, and Van sings, and Van screams, and Van listens, and Van says, "Up them all," and becomes Van. And what the hell, that's his friend, and now he can live with himself. This LP is Van Morrison. We won't explain it to you. With this one, go for yourself. Morrison was furious. But he didn't have much time to yell at Burns. The producer died 3 months later. If Morrison found Burns difficult to deal with, what came next was worse. At a certain point in the 60s, Burt Burns became fascinated by people associated with the mob. Fascination became friendship, and friendship turned to business. Now that Burns was dead, Morrison's main contact at Bang Records was Carmine Wassel DeNoia, whose father was the inspiration for the character Nicely Nicely in Guys and Dolls. Wassel was an even less forgiving boss than Burns. While the FBI classified him as only a low-level mobster, he was still a scary menace. In 1975, Wassel was convicted of payola, bribing radio DJs in exchange for heavy rotation of a record, which might not sound like rough work, until you hear how Wassel described a typical day. "So here's this disc jockey," Wassel said in 2001. I throw open the window, pick him up, flip him, shake him out by the ankles. Ninth floor. All the change fell out of his pockets. Some friends of mine picked it up. Even today, Wassel hasn't lost any of his tough guy shtick. When I ring him up one night, he answers, "Hello, City Morgue." He's lived for more than 50 years on West 72nd Street in Manhattan. When I arrive, he's wearing a loose white undershirt, blue pajama pants, and thick-rimmed black glasses. He's friendly, forthcoming, and a little scattered. "I helped that guy out," Wassel insists about Morrison. "If he ever sees me again, he better stand up and salute me." Wassel says he got Burt Burns started in the music business. Of course, Burns had been involved in the music business long before they met, so what he actually meant was that he introduced Burns to full-blown gangsters like Genovese family member Patsy Pagano, and to the quick results that brute force yielded when applied to the creative industries. Back in Burns's day, this included everything from bullying performers back into studios, dismantling local record bootlegging operations with a sledgehammer, and finding ways to borrow money that didn't require a credit check. These connections gave Burns and Bang Records an advantage that could level the playing field against more established labels. In August 1967, Burns organized a belated record release party for Brown Eyed Girl on a boat that departed from 50th Street in Manhattan. Van attended with his new love, Janet Rigsby. There's a picture from this evening hanging on Wassel's wall. The framed photo shows the singer sporting a rare smile. Janet looks happily taken aback by the fanfare. Burns is glancing at Janet, and Wassel is in back, a giant cigar stuffed in his mouth, with eyes closed and head tilted back. Performer Tiny Tim tried to join the festivities that night, I learn, but Wassel says he threw him overboard into the Hudson River. "They had to fish him out of there," Wassel tells me, laughing. "He was soaked." At some point in the evening, Morrison delivered a soulful solo set for the revelers. I ask Wassel to tell me more about what happened with Van Morrison right before the singer fled New York. For a moment, he looks stumped. "Oh," Wassel remembers, "I broke his guitar on his head." This is true. Here's what happened. One night, Wassel visited the singer at the King Edward Hotel where Morrison and Janet were staying. They were already anxious. Morrison's immigration papers were not wholly in order, and he was worried about being deported. His last visit to an office trying to correct the work permit issue ended with an official telling him, "You're now deported. Bye-bye." During the encounter with Wassel, Morrison was severely intoxicated. Wassel asked about a radio he had given Morrison, which now appeared to be broken. Morrison's temper flared up, worsened by booze, so Wassel put an end to his incomprehensible string of expletives by smashing the singer's acoustic guitar over his head. Morrison would later tell others that he and Janet once returned from dinner to find their hotel door full of bullet holes. Neil Diamond, Burns's other poised-to-make-it act at the time, reported similar calamities. The unholy hell that was unleashed upon Van when Burt died was really horrible, Janet recalls, noting another instance where Wassel banged on their door, screaming, "You're finished in the business, do you hear me?" All of this may have had something to do with why, in early 1968, Van Morrison and Janet Rigsby hastily got married and moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts. By August 1968, shortly before his audition with Louis Marenstein, but after literally dreaming up his new acoustic sound, Morrison booked several shows under the name The Van Morrison Controversy to hone his new material and sound. What the titular brouhaha referred to was never specified, but the fact that his record contract led to bullet holes in a hotel door might be a good starting point. These shows took place at a nightclub called the Catacombs at 1120 Boylston Street in the Fenway, two floors below a pool parlor. Today, it's a stack of rehearsal studios beneath a pizza joint. Hieroglyphics decorated the walls. The club mostly hosted jazz, but Morrison's Poet Rock fit right in. At this point, the band had dwindled down to Morrison on guitar and bassist Tom Kilbanya. John Sheldon, the guitar wunderkind, had been ditched, and drummer Joey Bebo had left of his own volition. At a jam session near the docks of Lewis Wharf in Boston, Kilbanya recruited a flute player named John Payne. Payne was 22, on one of many leaves of absence from his studies at Harvard, stuck editing high school math books for Houghton Mifflin. Kilbanya excitedly talked to Payne about what lay on the horizon. "We're recording an album. We're going to Europe." Though Payne was strictly into jazz, the gig sounded better than staring at equations all day. Payne remembers meeting Morrison in the back of the catacombs. This guy comes out, a short guy with a pageboy, a blank look on his face. Tom says, "Van, this is the guy I was telling you about." He goes, "Hey," and gives me a limp hand. He was just in his own world. As Payne watched from the audience, Morrison and Kilbanya began to play. "I listened to the first set, and I didn't like it," Payne says. "I thought, the guy doesn't seem like he wants me to be here. Maybe the bass player is forcing me on him. And until I'm on the stage with him, I don't get it." Then Payne joined the pair for the second set. "I started playing a little, and I could tell he had heard everything I had played, and he was reacting to it. His phrasing was not independent of what I was doing, and I had never experienced that. This was alive." Then he starts the next song, and it's Brown-Eyed Girl. Payne was shocked. He was playing with the man whose voice he'd been hearing on the jukebox for months. "I could still play, but it was like, oh my God!" In the audience, Eric Kraft was spellbound. He'd been assigned to cover Morrison's string of catacomb shows for an underground weekly called Boston After Dark. Decades later, he still recalls it in vivid detail. "It was so amazing," he says. "It changed my life, actually." The following night, Kraft managed to get the taciturn Morrison talking. Sitting on the kitchen floor of the club, Morrison spoke of his label troubles, the songs he was writing, his hopes for himself. In turn, Kraft revealed his own dream. It was the first time he had told anyone that he wanted to be a fiction writer. Morrison told him to go for it. "The fact that it interested him was very propulsive for me," says Kraft, who has since published 11 books and a multi-volume novel about the life of his alter ego, Peter LeRoy. "It pushed me forward." That night, he went home and woke up his wife to tell her what he had just seen. In his review, Kraft conveys the evening's power. Van winces and strains to bring the song up from far within him, producing at times a strangely distant sound that carries a lyric of loss and disillusionment. He has total control over the number and, by now, over most of the audience as well. Bassist Kilbanya is weaving and rocking as though there were a string tying him to Morrison's hand. It looks like the flute player is going to work out. He improvises a fine solo. When the number ends, the applause is long and heartfelt. Karen is smiling. Everybody is smiling. Christ, it's going to be beautiful. When the album comes out in October or November, buy several. I mention a rumor I'd heard a while back that Peter Wolf made an audio recording of one of these nights at the catacombs. Kraft gasps at the possibility that one of the most important moments of his life has been preserved and might be accessed again. If they exist, Wolf's tapes would have historic importance. Morrison reportedly performed much of Astral Weeks these nights with the Boston Trio, a lineup that never received any substantial credit for helping shape songs that would end up on the album. P. Peter Wolf, of course, went on to be the charismatic singer for the hit-making Jay Giles Band, not to mention the husband of actress Faye Dunaway, but he currently lives alone in Boston. I had to find out whether those tapes were real, and if I could hear them. Back at the catacombs, Van Morrison also met the man who would extricate him from Bang Records' mob ties. His savior was a former Boston DJ turned Warner Brothers executive named Joe Smith. In the 1950s, Smith recalls being the first guy who played real rock and roll on Boston radio. In 1968, he was at the catacombs on a tip from a colleague. Plenty of people were interested in signing Morrison, but the singer's lack of social graces coupled with the Bang Records baggage wasn't helping his cause. Smith wasn't impressed with Morrison's personality. "He was a hateful little guy," he recalls. "His live performance? He may as well have been in Philadelphia. There's no action from him. But his voice. I still think he's the best rock and roll voice out there." Smith set the wheels in motion right away, asking producer Louis Merenstein to travel to Boston to audition the singer. Merenstein would narrowly beat Bob Dylan and Velvet Underground producer Tom Wilson to Boston by a matter of days. Meanwhile, Smith also needed to figure out a way to erase Morrison's ties with the unsavory side of Bang Records. There was a guy in town named Joe Scandori who was Don Rickles' manager, and he was connected, Smith says. "I had to go to him and say, 'How can I get this deal through so I can release this guy?' And he set up the arrangement." The arrangement sounds completely terrifying. At 6 p.m. on 9th Avenue in Manhattan, Joe Smith entered an abandoned warehouse with a sack containing $20,000 in cash. Smith remembers how it went down. "I had to walk up three flights of stairs, and there were four guys, two tall and thin, and two built like buildings. There was no small talk. I got the signed contract and got the hell out of there, because I was afraid somebody would whack me in the head and take back the contract and I'd be out the money." Did he ever hear from these people again? No, Smith deadpans. They weren't in the music business. Regardless, the transaction was a success. The moment that Smith dropped that sack of money on the warehouse floor, a clear path toward the creation of Astral Weeks opened up before him. Van Morrison was now signed to Warner Brothers. With its roots in tempers, outbursts, gangsters, and violence, it's ironic that Astral Weeks ended up being an album completely preoccupied with notions of transcendence and the sublime. But the love story at its core was just as significant to Morrison's reality in 1968. Morrison began calling his new wife Janet Planet, probably because it rhymed, she says. In a mad rush, they moved into an apartment in a disheveled little building on Green Street in Cambridge. It was not a wonderful place to live. What more than made up for the unpleasant surroundings, though, was the astonishingly fertile creative period we found ourselves in, she remembers. The couple was broke, hungry, and hunted. But it was there, sitting at their tiny kitchen table, strumming an acoustic guitar, that Morrison wrote and refined much of Astral Weeks. "We both absolutely believed that once people heard this music, Van would be back on track, career-wise," Janet says. "I'm very thankful that the world has at length caught up with what we both knew in 1968. Janet Planet kept track of Morrison's songs and lyrics for him, listened to the demos, and helped him revise. "Van liked to work in a sort of stream-of-consciousness way back then," she says, "letting the tape recorder continue to run while he just sort of played guitar and improvised, trying various things for 20 minutes or so at a time. Then we would go back, listen, and decide what was good, what to keep, tidy up rhyme scheme, and then try it out again. It was a fascinating process, both to witness and to be part of. The end result of Janet's organizational assistance would be a binder of Van's new songs, a tome he would later flip through during the sessions trying to find a tune to close the album that satisfied Marenstein. From the outside, the years immediately following Astral Weeks seemed like a fairy tale for the couple. Morrison and Janet moved to Woodstock, New York, and then to California. They had a daughter named Shanna. As Morrison's muse, Janet appeared in several press photos. She even wrote the liner notes for a few albums. "We were finally really living in a dreamland," Janet Planet said, remembering the scant, blissful period the couple found post-Astral Weeks. She sits atop a horse on the cover of Tupelo Honey, with a grounded Morrison proudly at her side. Her original liner notes for Moondance, titled A Fable, quite literally translated their story into a fairy tale. But as the myth of Van Morrison grew, his relationship with Janet shattered irreversibly. Even before California, she said, "Our life was very traumatic and horrible. I couldn't stand any more of his rage as my daily reality." In Morrison's account, Janet wanted too much socializing, which didn't leave enough room for all the work he wanted to complete. "I was confusing the music with the man," Planet recalled. "The music was everything you could hope for as a romantic. The man was a prickly bear." In 1973, Janet left, filing for divorce a few months later. When I find her via her Etsy shop, Love Beads by Janet Planet, she's listed as Janet Morrison Minto out of Sherman Oaks, California. She can no longer bear to hear her ex-husband's music. "Being a muse is a thankless job, and the pay is lousy," she says. I suppose it could be considered unfortunate that hearing the intro to Brown Eyed Girl come over the grocery store speaker system is my signal to hit the checkout counter and get out ASAP. Imagine a world in which your memory of an early, intense, turbulent relationship gets constantly triggered by a pop song nearly as ubiquitous now as it was during its heyday 50 years ago. What mechanisms might you put in place to protect yourself from repeatedly re-experiencing that pain? To this day, however, Janet still recalls the small window of happiness the two found, and the music he conjured during their time together. I'm sure that no one loved his artistry more or believed in his greatness more than me. As for the songwriter himself, his personal thoughts on Astral Weeks change from interview to interview. He said it was originally planned as an opera, and also that it's just a random assortment of songs. That the arrangements are too samey and, incredibly, that it's not a personal record. "It's not about me," he told NPR in 2009. "It's totally fictional. It's put together of composites, of conversations I heard, you know, things I saw in movies, newspapers, books, whatever. It comes out as stories. That's it. There's no more." If Janet Morrison Minto has to walk out of a store when Brown-Eyed Girl starts playing, perhaps Morrison's claim that these songs have nothing to do with his own life is his strategy for dealing with the painful memories. After all, Morrison earns his living by singing those songs into a microphone every night. What would you do? Peter Wolfe is a difficult man to get a hold of. I'm in touch with a friend of Wolfe's who sometimes facilitates meetings and interviews. The initial phone calls establish that Wolfe is hesitant to share stories right now. Months pass. More calls and demurrals. Out of the blue, one day I receive a phone call from a blocked number. "Hi, this is Peter." We arrange to meet that weekend. Wolf's friend advises me to bring some pastries or my favorite book to the interview. "I can't tell you what it is exactly," he instructs me, just that it come from the heart. The day of the interview, Wolf delays it by a few hours in the afternoon. Then I'm instructed to sit in the lobby of a nearby hotel and wait. Peter calls again shortly after. He's not ready to meet yet, but he asks me a dozen questions about Van Morrison that he already knows the answers to. It's one last level of vetting, which I think I pass. 30 minutes later, I'm told that maybe Peter would like to meet at my apartment instead. I'm starting to think this is all some sort of elaborate prank. Wolf is Boston rock royalty, but the levels of clearance and foreplay are getting excessive. I consider returning back home when my voicemail lights up with an address and a time. It's 10:15 p.m. on a Saturday night, and I'm walking down the hallway of a downtown high-rise toward Peter Wolf's place, carrying a box of fancy mini cheesecakes. He opens the door before I even knock. He's wearing a dark suit and one of his signature hats. He welcomes me in and offers me a drink. The living room is set up for consuming music. For example, where you might place a television, there is a coffee table stacked with a turntable, CD deck, and receivers, flanked by two deluxe tower speakers. The walls are lined with LPs and books. I scan the room, thinking I might spot the boxes that house the tapes of Morrison performing in 68. No such luck. He returns with two tumblers of whiskey and compliments me on my choice of pastries. I motion to my tape recorder and tell him, "I'm going to start rolling now." Wolf shakes his head. He hands me a pencil and a piece of paper, insisting he made Keith Richards' biographer do the same. "My band then was called The Hallucinations," Wolf begins, as I scribble to keep up. "A kind of neo-punk thing. We practiced at the Boston Tea Party on Berkeley Street. One day during rehearsal, this guy came into the club looking for a gig. He was speaking real funny. The singer was already a fan of Morrison's work. At the time, Them's Gloria was like the national anthem for every garage band in the country," Wolf says. "Even so, the gigs and opportunities in Boston weren't coming easy. We became friends quickly. He'd come over to use my telephone because he and Janet barely had anything at the time. Meanwhile, Wolf had an overnight shift DJing at 104.1 WBCN. Boston's new free-form radio station, where he'd take on a persona he called the Woofa Goofa. Wolf committed to doing all his on-air talking as the Woofa character, emitting a hyper-fast stream of consciousness combination of total jive and rock and roll minutiae. Shortly after Morrison moved to town, Wolf began receiving postcards at the station requesting a myriad of obscure blues artists. As they continued to run into each other, Morrison began telling Wolf about this great Boston DJ he was listening to late at night. Wolf revealed his on-air identity. Morrison copped to being the correspondent, and the two were bonded for life. Morrison would come by WBCN and play records with Woofa Goofa all night long. Wolf introduced Morrison to musicians in town. They hung out after hours at clubs, partied with bands that rolled through Boston. Wolf opens a small drawer in front of him and pulls out a stack of photographs, all related to his friendship with Morrison. He hands me a picture of the two of them, so happy and soused that I almost get drunk just looking at it. Wolf tells me you get really close with someone once you've thrown up on each other. Did Wolf pick up a copy of Astral Weeks right when it came out? "There's a test pressing of it somewhere here," he says, motioning to his wall of records. He found the album so unexpected, almost baroque. As he pulls various Van records off the shelf, he scans the liner notes and offers his memories of days gone by. Eventually, I bring up the live recordings from 1968. "When is the last time you've listened to that recording from the catacombs, Peter?" Wolf stares at me, trying to remember. not for a very, very, very long time. Neither of us says anything. We'd have to bake the tapes, Wolf finally adds. When a reel of magnetic tape has been left alone for decades, deterioration occurs in a way that if you simply played the tapes again, it might sound fine, but you'd be forever destroying the recording as you went, with layers of the reel shedding off as it passes through the machine. One solution to prevent this outcome is to place the reels in an oven and bake them before playback. I have a vision of the both of us donning aprons and putting the legendary recordings inside Wolf's stove right then and there. That, of course, doesn't happen. He mentions a specialist up in Maine who could do the transfer properly. I excuse myself to use the bathroom. When I return, he's staring at something on the bookshelf. Here they are, he says, pointing to a spot that had been right behind my head the entire time. It's surreal to finally lay eyes on something you've been imagining for so long, to see what it looks like rather than what your imagination insisted it would be. Here are two slender tape boxes, faded and worn, tiny labels affixed to both with Wolf's notations in faded ink. Van Morrison Trio, The Catacombs, 1968. Would you ever let me hear these? Sure, Wolf says. If we got them transferred, sure. When I close my notebook, he becomes visibly more relaxed. He sits down in front of his table of stereo equipment and cues something up. I hear the hiss of an unmastered recording and a riff played on an acoustic guitar. After 5 seconds, Wolf hits pause, raises his eyebrows, and asks, "What is it?" I know the riff, but after having seen what I consider the holy grail of musical artifacts, I'm absolutely useless. Wolf hits play, revealing a demo recording of Morrison's song, Domino. He shows me old postcards Van sent from Fairfax, California, then recites a poem called The Cold Heart of the Stone, about their time together in 1968. What I had interpreted as rock diva behavior with the day's earlier delays had actually been Wolf taking the time to prepare a proper presentation of his Morrison-related memories. It's easy to take this too far. I pick up a little jar from the table of snacks and hold it up to him. "Did you put this out on purpose?" I ask, showing him the brand name Tupelo Honey. Wolf laughs and says no. Wolf walks me to his building's front door, and we end up talking for another 30 minutes. He tells me about seeing Woody Guthrie as a child, and how he was in the audience the night Bob Dylan recited the poem Last Thoughts on Woody Guthrie. As we chat, a steady stream of older, well-dressed partygoers exit the building, headed home. Just as another pack walks by, I swear I hear one of them say, "Van the Man." I must be imagining things. I decide not to bring it up. Wolf continues with his story for a moment longer, then pauses and points outside. "Did that guy just say Van the Man?" I nod. "That's really weird," Wolf says, a mischievous smile on his face. Somewhere in the middle of that night I spent in Wolf's apartment, he told me a story about one of the times Van Morrison came back to town. He wouldn't clarify the date or give me any additional context. All he told me was this. It's late at night. Van Morrison is exhausted after his concert in Boston, but there's one thing he still wants to do while he's here. He gets into a car with Wolf and picks a destination. Wolf drives down Mass Ave heading into Cambridge. Nothing looks like it did in 1968, but then again, neither do the two men in the car. They turn onto a series of side streets. As they approach the address, Wolf slows down to a crawl, because neither of them has been here in a long, long time, and it looks barely familiar. Just past the intersection of Bay and Green Streets, Wolf points out the window to the left, where Van and Janet, his planet, cosmic partner, entire world, lived in 1960.